This is Law and Disorder.
Last week, we interviewed Michael Avery, president of the National Lawyers Guild, and Shane Katidal, a staff attorney at the Center for Constitutional Rights, just after their successful oral argument in federal court on the question of whether the National Security Agency, without any warrants, can spy on the conversations between the center's attorneys and their clients.
Already one federal judge has so held. The government really has nothing on its side, yet it persists and continues in warrantless wiretapping our phone calls and our email.
Listeners will remember that several weeks ago, we interviewed Shanti Sells and Daniel Strauss, two people down at the Arizona border who were arrested and threatened with long prison terms for daring to rescue and take two Mexican immigrants to a hospital.
We have surprising good news for you on that front. Although obviously the question of immigration from Mexico and what we are doing to people in the desert is still a very serious topic.
Recently, the government of Mexico has announced the victory of presidential candidate Felipe Calderón. Millions of people are in the streets and camped in Mexico City as we broadcast. The situation is the most extraordinary, perhaps even revolutionary situation that's developed so far in Latin America.
You can only fool most of the people most of the time. At some point, people act, and what's happening now in Mexico is a rising up from under. Welcome to Law and Disorder. This is Michael Ratner, president of the Center for Constitutional Rights.
I'm Michael Smith, New York City attorney and author.
I'm Heidi Boghossian, executive director of the National Lawyers Guild.
I'm Dahlia Hashad, director of the USA program at Amnesty International.
Here on Law and Disorder, we four lawyers and activists will strive to be your eyes and ears, your early warning system, your educators, counselors, and advocates. Here, we'll talk about the laws, practices, and procedures that we believe are strangling democracy. We'll be in the courts, in the books, on the streets, and here on the radio with you. We hope that we'll be lawyers you will like.
The great civil liberties attorney Bill Kunstler saw it coming. The police state is emerging, he warned. It's coming piece by piece, before and especially after September 11th.
Periodically on Law and Disorder, we bring you updates on various human rights and civil rights issues, but particularly concerning the war on terror, 9/11, and Guantanamo. Today I want to talk briefly about what's going on with Guantanamo and recent efforts in our Congress to again override the Supreme Court. As people may recall, in June of this year, the Supreme Court, 5-3, came down with a Hamden decision. The Hamden decision said, first of all, that the Geneva Conventions apply to people picked up in the so-called War on Terror. That means that they had to have fair trials and that they had to be treated humanely. In the end, what that meant for the President of the United States was that the military commissions that he had set up were no longer lawful, they weren't authorized, and what it meant for the torturers at hand from the CIA and from the military was that they might very well be charged with war crimes for what they did to people both at Guantanamo and in CIA secret sites. Since that time, of course, we've had the President on September 6th give a major speech in which he claimed to want to continue military commissions despite what the Supreme Court said, and that he was going to go to Congress to ask them now to approve military commissions, commissions that would not allow people to see all the evidence against them, that would permit evidence that came from torture, and that would on occasion have the defendant actually excluded from seeing any of the evidence. The president also suggested that he liked having the CIA be able to have the authority to torture people. Didn't use those exact words, but that's what he meant. And therefore, he was going to ask Congress essentially to amend the Geneva Conventions. Well, we're now at the crisis point. The Republicans are somewhat afraid that they could lose the House in the fall elections, and they are trying to rush through now a new statute, new legislation that will put into place what the president has been unlawfully and illegally doing for the 5 years since 9/11. This new legislation to essentially give the president maximum authority to really be a dictator in this country may well occur today, September 18th. It's supposed to go to the full floor of the Senate today. It may not, but my view is that it may, and it's a disaster. And if there's something we want our listeners to do, it's to really get into this issue immediately and do what you can. One way you can do something is go to the center's website. That's ccr-ny.org, ccr-ny.org, and write those people who are important on this issue to, first of all, not strip the courts of the right to hear cases from Guantanamo. That's the main part of this legislation that we at the center see as really harmful. What the legislation is trying to do is say that anybody in custody of the United States, outside the United States, that's anybody in Guantanamo, anybody in Bagram, anybody in Iraq, can no longer come into American courts and test their detention. In other words, deny the writ of habeas corpus to these people. If you want to talk about a definition of a police state, that's it. The president can pick up someone anywhere in the world, hold them in detention forever, and never, ever have to try them. That's what we may be facing today, this Monday, that Senate vote. Obviously, crucial people are the senators from this state, Senator Schumer, Senator Clinton, other senators around the country. Those are the crucial. This is a Senate vote. So first of all, you want to tell them, don't strip the courts of habeas corpus jurisdiction. Don't strip the courts of the right to hear cases of people in American custody. That's the crucial message. The second message you want to give people is don't change the Geneva Conventions. They protect us. They protect our own soldiers. They require humane treatment. Don't allow the United States to actually put in laws that say it's okay to torture. Yes, this government tortures, but now they actually want to get Congress to say, rubber stamp it and go along. Yes, we can torture. And third, when and if they try people, make sure you tell your member of Congress, those people who are on trial have to get essential protections. And one reason, apart from humane reasons they do, is if you want to convict people of terrorism or any crime, you want to convict the right people and not the wrong people. And the laws that are being contemplated, allowing evidence from torture, will obviously not convict the right people. But the key here, what we're seeing, is now that the president has lost in the Supreme Court twice, he is now coming to Congress. And the question really that Congress must ask itself, and we all have to ask ourselves, is Congress simply going to be a rubber stamp for dictatorship? I fear the worst. I fear the worst. But get active on it. Go to our website, ccr-ny.org, and get yourself active. Obviously, it's not the only way to stop this, and it's a last-minute thing. We have to, in the end, of course, do something very differently about our power in the streets. But in the short term, we've got to ensure that this country doesn't actually put on to the books a police state.
Weeks ago, oral arguments were held in federal court in a lawsuit brought by the Center for Constitutional Rights. The suit seeks to stop Bush and the government agencies from conducting warrantless surveillance of international communications made from the United States, such as phone calls and emails. Arguing the case were Shane Katadal of CCR and cooperating attorney Michael Avery, who is president of the National Lawyers Guild. One issue is whether CCR and several of its lawyers have standing to bring the suit. Namely, they are required to demonstrate a concrete injury from the spying program. CCR lawyers say that their ability to conduct their work has been affected by the chance that their confidential attorney-client communications may be monitored. The government asserted that Judge Lynch should dismiss the case because allowing it to proceed would jeopardize national security. It also argued that the president has the inherent constitutional power to override congressional enactments like the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act, an argument that Judge Lynch seemed visibly troubled by. Law and Disorder caught up with Shane Katadal and Michael Avery after their three-hour argument. Welcome once again to Law and Disorder, Michael Avery and Shane Katadal.
Thanks for having us.
My pleasure, Heidi. Good to have you here. You guys filed a lawsuit on behalf of the Center for Constitutional Rights, the attorneys there, and the clients you represent back in January of this year. It's now September. The judge is finally hearing it. You asked for summary judgment. Please explain what that is and tell us what's at stake here.
Well, Michael, summary judgment basically means that we believe we ought to win this case without any further discovery of facts or without a trial to elucidate more facts, just based on what the administration has admitted about this program. And what they've admitted is essentially that they never go to judges to get warrants for the kind of surveillance that they're doing, and that they're doing surveillance on people they suspect of some link to terrorism, who are calling from outside the United States into the United States or vice versa. Basically, that these are international calls. And that's of concern to us because we represent a number of people who are now located overseas. In our other cases, we represent them. And we need to call them in the course of carrying on this litigation. And the government has said in the past that these people are people who have links to terrorism. So our clients are exactly the sort of people who the government has said they're listening in on with this program.
The government, I guess, thinking a good defense is the best offense, made a motion to dismiss your case and say you have no standing to sue. They got no business even being in court. What's that all about?
The government is trying to keep this case out of court in any way that it can. And so it's setting up several procedural obstacles to the case being heard. The first is their argument that since the program is secret, nobody can know for sure whether they've actually been overheard. They argue that if you haven't been overheard, you really have no standing to bring the case. And since you can't be sure you've overheard, because the program is secret, no one can bring the case. That's their first argument. Their second argument is that to defend this case, they would have to rely on all sorts of secret information about who they're listening to and how they're listening to them and what sorts of technology they're using and things of that sort. Because that information cannot be revealed, the case can't be heard and has to be dismissed. Consequence of that argument is that even if the president is breaking the law that Congress passed, and even if he's acting outside his sphere of constitutional power so that his actions are unconstitutional, nobody could actually bring an effective challenge in court.
How is this case different from some of the other challenges to electronic surveillance cases in that it involves attorneys and the relationship with clients?
We think that the fact that we have attorney-client communications that might be the target of this surveillance here makes it an especially good case in terms of standing. We feel that we're harmed just by the fact that this program poses a risk to our communications. Now, the ACLU's case is very similar to ours in that the one difference is that they also have journalists on top of criminal defense attorneys and their own attorneys that are plaintiffs in their case. And so, they're concerned about conversations of journalists talking to their sources, for instance, people calling up folks in Iraq and trying to get information about the situation on the ground there. Then there are a couple other suits of interest. There's one that's solely against AT&T for its participation in the program. And there they seem to have some hard evidence from a whistleblower that shows that, that tends to show that the program might have been intercepting a lot of domestic communications and that it may not have been targeted at all, that it might have been basically a data mining program where they're trying to sweep in everyone's communications. And then finally, there's a fourth case of interest in Oregon where the plaintiffs claim they have a document that shows that the NSA listened in on phone calls between a charity in Oregon and their lawyers in Washington, D.C. So both domestic and attorney-client calls at risk.
The government has here, they call the Terrorist Surveillance Program, and it's almost 5 years old. It came in right after 9/11. And listening to the government, they were pretty firm. They said, we're trying to protect people in this country. There was a terrorist attack on 9/11. There's a war going on. We're trying to defend people. We need to pull the trigger right away if we suspect that a terrorist is in contact with somebody here in the United States. We're just trying to help here. You people would trade away our security for some abstract principle. I think they mentioned Al-Qaeda four different times. They mentioned Osama bin Laden two different times. How do you win against that kind of fear-mongering?
The position we're taking and the position the Congress has taken in the past is not that the president cannot do electronic surveillance of people who are agents of al-Qaeda. The position we're taking is that if the president wants to do that kind of electronic surveillance, he has to get a warrant from a judge or from the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Court, and he has to follow the law that Congress has established. If the president says that law is inadequate to meet the needs of the kind of surveillance that he wants to do today, then he should go to Congress and he should make some suggestions about how the law can be changed. But what we don't want to see is the president and the executive branch of the government unilaterally making all the decisions about who they're going to listen to and under what circumstances, with no review by Congress and no review by the courts.
Doesn't that Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act, that goes all the way back, I think, to 1978, doesn't it say that it's the exclusive way that you go about getting a warrant to spy on people?
It not only says that and Title III, the 1968 Electronic Surveillance Act, are the exclusive ways of doing this type of surveillance. It says that it's a criminal offense, a felony, punishable by 5 years to do it any other way. And there's no doubt in my mind, as a lawyer and as a constitutional law professor, that President Bush is guilty of this 5-year felony. And I think he should be impeached on that basis. And I think he should be held liable and accountable for what he's done.
In the indictment, also name General Hayden, Michael Hayden, the new head of the CIA, and Attorney General Alberto Gonzalez, both of whom are into this. It was scary when they kept talking about general this and general that. I remember your last comment. You told the judge, if Alexander Hamilton was alive, he'd be here in the courtroom today. It seems to me that there are real principles of democracy at stake here when the president says that he has the inherent power to circumvent Congress, to not even reveal information to the judiciary, to just do whatever he deems necessary. That's the kind of thing that the Founding Fathers were discussing before the Constitution was written, when they established the 3 different branches of government and tried to prevent what they said would be a certain tyranny if the executive had all the power.
Well, you know, nearly 40 years ago, Justice Jackson, in his opinion in the Steele seizure case,
which came up today.
Yes, when President Harry Truman tried to seize the steel mills to keep the workers from going out on strike so that they could manufacture weapons and munitions for the war in Korea, Justice Jackson, in his opinion, said the same person is the head of the civilian government and the commander in chief, so that there's civilian control over the military, not so that there's military control over civilian life. And that's an important lesson that needs to be brought to bear on this issue today.
Michael and Shane, Michael Smith and I were really delighted to be able to attend today's proceeding. And I know that I went in expecting sort of formal oral arguments from both of you, but instead the judge decided to really question and answer, and it was a very educational experience. How did you feel about how the afternoon went?
Well, it was a really intense 2.5 hours, and you know, Lynch, by reputation, is one of the smartest couple of judges in the federal system, a brilliant Columbia professor before he was a judge, and I think he showed us why he has that reputation today. He knew this case backwards and forwards, and he was interested in the fine details. He had already thought through a lot of different variations on how the case would play out. He was interested in really having a nice, solid discussion with us about the details.
It's what we call a hot bench. He was totally prepared. What worries me, his opening comments when he said that he hadn't made a decision to have oral argument on this for 8 months since the case was filed, because he was thinking maybe Congress would step in and decide the issue. And then he was thinking maybe this commission on civil courts that's supposed to decide questions if there's kind of a chance for contradictory decisions, maybe they would decide the issue. Neither one of them came through. Here he is 8 months later, stuck with having to decide the thing. He indicated that he reads the papers. I'm sure he reads the Times. We all read the article about Judge Taylor in Detroit 2 weeks ago when she decided the Hamden decision, which I wanted to ask you about. But the government came down on her like a ton of bricks. She didn't reason correctly. She wrote it too quickly. It was a bad decision. I mean, we thought that really what they were saying, that she was a black woman judge, who was a liberal. But I think that our current Judge Lynch is probably thinking he's in the same line of fire.
Michael, I had a different take on that. I thought he was going out of his way to be fair. He also said, in addition to waiting to see how other things came out, that he had intentionally not read the confidential materials that the state had presented. What did you think of that, Shane and Michael?
I was a little bit surprised to hear it. I suppose his rationale made perfect sense, that he didn't want to inadvertently divulge anything that was in those materials by asking a question that would have been based on them. But it was really very surprising to hear him at the outset say that he had waited for months on not ruling on what is basically a separation of powers question in order that maybe Congress could change its mind about the FISA statute.
I was a little surprised by that, but on reflection, it makes a certain amount of sense to me, in that one of the things we're arguing is that if the president wants to have a different technology or wants to have a different set of criteria for engaging in this kind of surveillance, he ought to go to Congress, and Congress ought to entertain changing the statute. Now, there are a number of ways in which the statute could be changed that we would oppose, and I'm certainly not in favor of the bill that Senator Spector currently has floated in the Senate. But as a constitutional law matter, the Congress should make it clear at this point that either they're not going to change the law and the president is going to be held to the previous law, or if there are some changes that everybody can agree on, then they can be made. But institutionally, that's quite a sensible approach, I think.
You know what I'm afraid of? That if we do win in the lower court, and it gets all the way up to the Supreme Court, it's really a question here of the inherent powers of the president. And Roberts, the latest justice, during his confirmation, gave an indication that there's nothing the executive would do that he would disapprove of. And if the composition of the Supreme Court changes by one person, we're going to have a 5-4 majority that agrees with Roberts, that has this kind of notion of the president is unlimited in his authority to do whatever he wants. And I think that this case may be headed towards the Supreme Court.
Unless Congress does act, or unless there's a statute passed directing this to some other court, I mean, there's a variety of sort of options that are out there. But if this case goes in the ordinary fashion, it will get to the Supreme Court. I'm somewhat optimistic on the basis of recent Supreme Court rulings, where in three different cases, the Supreme Court has said to the president, you've gone too far, you can't contradict the will of Congress, you can't hold people without hearings, you can't violate constitutional rights in the name of the war on terror. I mean, there's Justice O'Connor's famous remark, war is not a blank check to the president to do whatever he wants on the domestic side. Now, of course, Justice O'Connor's not on the court anymore, and as you point out, she's been replaced by people more conservative. This president has gone so far to provoke a constitutional crisis that people of goodwill and intelligent people, there's a strong chance that they'll stand up to him when the time comes.
Going back to this afternoon in the courtroom, when the state was answering the judge's questions, did anything surprise you in terms of their responses?
They dropped a bombshell in the courtroom this afternoon, which was that up until now, they had never argued in any of these cases or in any of their public statements that what they were doing was not covered by the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act. Mr. Coppolino, on behalf of the government, made that argument today. He said, well, since we can't reveal what technology we're using and exactly how we're intercepting these conversations, we're not prepared to concede that they're within the rubric of the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act. The judge appeared quite startled by that. In fact, he asked the lawyer for the government, I think I'm pretty good at reading your papers, and I didn't see that in them. And of course, the government lawyer's argument flatly contradicts what the Attorney General and the head of NSA have said about the program. So I think it was a disingenuous argument, and to me, it demonstrates that the government will do anything it can to try to keep this case from being resolved on the merits of the constitutional law.
Although you know, it's interesting that it's possible that the government attorney doesn't really actually know a whole lot of the details of this program. You know, there are a number of things that lead me to say that. Among other things, a lot of the top attorneys with the DOJ, the top political appointees who have been defending a lot of the other big counterterrorism cases, have been notably absent from either the arguments or being signed on to the papers in this case. And that may be because all of those guys are tied up in the program somehow, that they've all been sort of implicated or dirtied their hands with it, that they've received information from the NSA. From NSA surveillance in the course of litigating some of those other cases, and it may also, you know, may just be the case that, you know, he's defending this case based on very limited information himself, for the same reasons that maybe the judge mentioned he hadn't read the classified information. So there are lots of interesting questions about their responses today.
One of the government's contentions is that you don't have standing because you can't really prove that you've been eavesdropped on. And I'm sure that in your briefs you allege damages, say that you have to travel now to meet with clients. You can't conduct business on telephone the way you have for many years. Do you think that argument can be overcome?
At the heart of it, I don't think that particular argument really has very much heft to it. The reality is that we have a professional obligation as lawyers to take countermeasures to this unlawful surveillance program. You know, the government came in and argued, you know, say, look, you know, if we could have gotten warrants to listen in on some of these same phone calls, given that these people that you represent are you know, we claim are Al-Qaeda members or otherwise linked with terrorism. But the reality is that every lawful wiretap program requires that the government put in measures to protect the confidentiality of privileged information, including things that you're saying to your attorneys. And that's what's missing from this case. There's no judge involved at all. There's no protection whatsoever for any privileged communications. And that makes it more difficult for us to, essentially, for us to challenge the administration's other unlawful behavior in court.
So, for example, under FISA, there are built-in judicial protections when it comes to attorney-client conversations.
Right. These things are generically called minimization procedures.
FISA is not exactly a civil libertarian's dream. I think they've issued over 10,000 surveillance warrants, 19,000, and they've only turned people down four times. They're up in a windowless room in the Justice Department in Washington. No one knows what the hell they do. It's really pretty much of a rubber stamp. Yet, Bush and his people went around FISA. And I got my own notions about why they did that. Why do you think they did that? What's going on here?
I think there are two explanations that have sort of thrown out there for this. I think one is that the program, in fact, is not targeted at individuals at all, that it's something much sort of broader scale, that it's essentially closer to a general warrant or a data mining program, that they're basically trying to listen in on every phone call or to copy every single email that's sent out there and then filter through them with machines and try to identify suspects in that way, that they're not focusing in on suspects, targeting suspects, but rather trying to pick people out of the ether. That's one theory, but the other theory is that they may be targeting the sorts of conversations that even very conservative FISA court judges wouldn't allow them to listen to.
So one just recently quit, didn't he? You wonder why.
That's right. I think Judge Robertson quit the FISA court in part because he was concerned that they were taking information from the NSA program and using it to get lawful FISA warrants and then bringing that information into court and criminal prosecutions, that they were basically sanitizing the NSA information by bringing it to the FISA judges and saying, look, we have this information, and not saying where it was from. You know, it could have been from informers or anything like that, rather than from an illegal surveillance program. But the conversations that we're really worried, you know, in our own capacity as lawyers about or that they might be listening to are these conversations of attorneys with their clients and journalists with their sources and that sort of thing. If the administration can chill those sorts of conversations, they can really cut off a huge avenue for criticism of their policies.
I know I'm very cautious about what I say on the phone. And I remember Michael Ratner coming back from Washington after he did a training session with a number of lawyers from really fine white shoe law firms that had volunteered on civil liberties basis to go down to Guantanamo and represent these detainees. Michael was explaining to them the ropes, what happens when we go down there. This is right after the Lynn Stewart indictment, and these guys were scared to death. They said, well, what if they tell me they've been tortured? Can I tell anybody? You know, I think everybody's looking over their shoulder now, especially the attorneys. And that's why we so enthusiastically commend the good work you did today in standing up for the attorneys and for all of us.
Well, thanks. Yeah, I was at that session, and it was amazing how many times the Lynn Stewart case was mentioned. I think 4 times in the first morning session alone. People concerned about this notion that anything that you talk to a client at Guantanamo about is per se classified. You can't even write notes in your office about what you talk to the client about. You've got to run it through the Department of Justice first so that they can clear your notes.
When they want to give a 65-year-old cancer-ridden woman who they've just disbarred 30 years in prison, probably she could get parole and only have to do about 28. But in any case, they said they want to do it to make an example out of her. And they've already made an example.
Was it unusual for the government to ask the judge if they could have time to respond, depending on how he ruled on this case?
No, how he indicated he might rule. That was very unusual, I thought. What did you guys think?
Well, the government has done everything it can to stall the progress of this case. They don't really want decisions to be made in these cases, and they want to postpone decisions for as long as possible. So that's part of what that was about. The other part of it was that they've been playing their cards pretty close to their chest. They want to get a look at what the judge is going to say in some initial decision, and then decide what they may or may not show of their cards after that.
Sure. I mean, you know, there one thing we haven't really talked about in detail here today is that they've made this assertion of the state secrets privilege, which the long and short of it is that, according to the government, the executive branch can come in, and as long as a cabinet level, you know, officer signs off on an affidavit saying that there's a risk that letting the case go forward would let classified secrets leak out, then the judge has to throw the case out. So it's basically a way for the president to say to the courts which cases they can and can't hear. And the government, you know, wants to be sure that they're going to win on that matter. And one of the things they've said is, look, we can't respond in substance to any of your allegations because the state secrets privilege applies here. But if the judge rejects that, they want to be able to come in and then say, you know, look, here are all the facts that mean that we ought to win. Reality is they'll probably just appeal at that point on the state secrets issue and try to stay all the other proceedings tied up in the courts for 2 more years.
It was really a pleasure to be able to talk to you in person after a long day in court, and we look forward to continuing to follow this important case.
Shane, Michael, it was terrific watching you guys work today. You really did a good job. You were extremely prepared. You were so prepared that things came easy to you. The judge and you guys had such a nice rapport. He really appreciated your intelligence.
He actually commented on it at the end for our listeners.
Good work. Keep making trouble.
Thank you.
Thanks. I felt a little bad about that when he said we were dispassionate. I was hoping a little bit more of our outrage would come through.
It'll come through over the air.
Right. Thank you both.
There's been a lot of recent news about the Mexican presidential election. Very clearly, as will be explained on this next segment of our show, the election was a fraud. López Obrador, the progressive candidate, should have won. And once again, and has happened in the past in Mexico, the election was stolen by a variety of means, surely by the interest of the United States to make sure that a progressive on their borders would not be the president of Mexico. But that's not all that's going on in Mexico. As our guest today, Jim Cockcroft will explain, there is much more than a street protest. What Mexico is experiencing now is very likely a pre-revolutionary situation in which people's power from the streets is coming up and has the potential to actually create a dual power structure in Mexico. An extremely hopeful view from south of the border.
Jim Cockcroft has written over 30 books. He's been to Mexico just recently, returned. He's really one of the great scholars of Latin America that we have here in the United States. We're so happy to have him on Law and Disorder. Welcome, Jim Cockcroft.
Hi.
You were in Mexico recently, right?
Correct.
How long ago?
Just a few weeks ago. I was there for about a week. Had a chance to see the people's encampments up and down the Paseo de la Reforma in the central plaza of Mexico, Zocalo, or the downtown area where you've had 7-week camp out protesting the fraudulent election of July 2nd.
Why do you say the elections were fraudulent?
First of all, they were not only fraudulent. This is a coup d'etat, because this was a coup d'etat that was announced before the election, 3 years before the election, and it's now come out on videotapes, so it's public knowledge, although the news blackout doesn't make it very available. The president, Fox, former President Salinas, who's a big power behind the scenes, and the attorney general and other high officials of the Mexican government set up a video programming of an official of López Obrador, the candidate they didn't want to run, and they tried to prevent from running with this scandal, taking a bribe. And then that person, the businessman, the Argentine businessman who was doing the dirty work for Fox and the others, later fled to Cuba and confessed in videotapes the Cubans have, which have now been published and made public in Mexico, that it was a setup in order to prevent López Obrador from running for president. And when that didn't work, they then accused López Obrador of a real estate fraud when he was governor of the federal district and tried to take away his immunity. He was, I think, at that point in office as governor. There was a march that I participated in a couple of years ago of 1.4 million Mexicans saying, you can't do that. We know this is trying to prevent democracy, prevent a candidacy. And then finally, during the campaign itself, the transnational corporations, Businessman's Council of Mexico, and the president again, from the equivalent of the Mexican White House, funded the conservative candidate and smeared López Obrador, calling him a danger for Mexico, the very words of the head of all the intelligence networks of the United States, Negroponte. He's the one who introduced that phrase, that López Obrador was a danger for Mexico. In other words, it was presidential intervention in a campaign which is against the Mexican Constitution. So the fraud actually was a coup d'etat in the making since 3 years ago. And then during the election itself, when it turned out that López Obrador is winning by 1 or 2 million votes, all of a sudden, some phone calls went around from the corrupt teachers union leader of the PRI to switch the PRI votes over to the conservative candidate of the PAN, who is now claiming he won the election. And this was a great transfer of hundreds of thousands of votes. And as you know, the official results only gave the PAN candidate a slim margin of 200,000.
Out of like 41 million or something?
Something like that, yeah. And then also when they investigated, they found that in many ballot boxes there were more ballots than voters. And in many other areas that were pro-López Obrador, there were fewer ballots than voters who had voted. And so there was basically about a 1 or 2 million vote fraud going on. That's the fraud that you sometimes hear about when you say fraudulent election July 2. But the real fraud and the real coup d'etat, sort of like a coup d'etat announced in advance, began 3 years ago, as I just explained.
Now, what's the situation post the election fraud and coup d'etat? You've recently come back from Mexico. What was your impression?
Well, I visited these encampments, and the spirit of the people is incredible. You have to understand that López Obrador proposed this idea shortly after July 2nd of simply sitting in permanently, forever, and that he would join them and camp out every night. That, in other words, for 24 hours a day, you will not leave your encampment in the central plaza of Mexico. And now, with the 7th week reaching completion, they've decided that since there were many mega marches in the course of this, one of which reached 3 million people in Mexico City. No, this is a mass movement. All the social movements came together under the demand of count all the votes, count all the ballot boxes. And when that was denied by the PRI-PAN Electoral Tribunal, that was set up by the PRI and the PAN without PRD votes earlier, and ratified by the corrupt Supreme Court that's been in power for years with never finding any justice for anyone. mega marches took place, the encampments took place, and then Lopez Obrador called for a National Democratic Convention. And this is the big story breaking in Mexico today, because that National Democratic Convention is going to lead to a constituent assembly, and it's also going to produce an alternative government or an alternative coordinator for the peaceful civic resistance. It's a very Gandhi-like peaceful movement led by López Obrador. It's going to call for an end to neoliberal economics and an end to poverty, protection for the poor, defense of the national patrimony, combat impunity and corruption, make the right to information a reality, in other words, break the news blackout.
Jim, just give a short explanation of the different political parties in Mexico, the PRI, the PAN.
Oh, yeah.
And whose interests they govern.
Well, the PRI ruled Mexico as the longest single ruling party in the history of humanity of any nation. And then it got tossed out in 1988 when a candidate of López Obrador's party, which was then had a different name, won, but then had the election stolen by Salinas, the PRI candidate. So the PRI stole one election in 88, not to count earlier ones, and then in 2000 it couldn't steal the election and Fox was elected. And a lot of people voted for Fox because they thought since the left-wing candidate couldn't win in 88, maybe a conservative candidate would be allowed in and that would break the PAN.
Fox was on the PAN party, is that right?
And that's the PAN, right, which is sort of the loyal opposition to the PRI for 80 years, and then got the equivalent of the White House in 2000 under Fox, who was a complete lackey of U.S. policies for Latin America vis-a-vis Cuba and the rest of the world, also in terms of delivering the economy lock, stock, and barrel to U.S. Transnational corporations. But the social movements prevented the delivery of all the oil, all the water, all the energy resources, and so on, but not the delivery of the banks and the rest of the economy. That's where we are today, handed over to the United States. It had already been handed over to the United States by Salinas and earlier presidencies. Those are the parties, the Conservative Party, which is very ultra-right wing, and its candidate is embraced by a very clerical, right-wing, pro-church, racist group called El Yunque, as well as the Businessmen's Council of Mexico. All the bourgeoisie of Mexico is united behind this right-wing candidate because they agree with Negroponte that López Obrador is, quote, a danger for Mexico.
So thank you, Jim, for that explanation. Now, going forward again to where we are with what kind of thing is being called for now and where is it going to take place?
A National Democratic Convention. It will take place on September 16th. The 15th and the 16th are Independence Day ceremonies for Mexico, independence from Spain. On the 16th, the Zocalo, by the way, will continue to be occupied. The encampments will break up at 3 a.m. the day before, and then to abandon that area so the military can have its traditional parade on the 16th. But the parade will be over by 3 p.m. on the 16th, and then the people will retake the Zocalo, hold their National Democratic Convention. They've been electing delegates from all over the country. They already have 500,000 delegates elected just from Greater Mexico City and Central Mexico area. They expect another 500,000 from the rest of the country, even though the delegates have to pay their own way. But once they get to Mexico, they will be housed. It'll be a National Democratic Convention of over 1 million delegates, and it will go as long as necessary. It's not decided whether it'll be just a quickie or a permanent one.
It's going to take place in the Zocalo, which is the central square in Mexico City.
That's
is that
correct.
Right?
That's correct. Right. And they'll have TV screens throughout the downtown area because when you have more than 1 million people, not to mention those who come to observe, including foreign dignitaries and prominent intellectuals from around the world, you have people spread throughout about a 10-square-mile area or 5-square-mile area. I forget the distances down there, but you have a lot of blocks.
Well, let me ask you. I think
it's like Lower Manhattan. It's as if you were taking up all of Lower Manhattan.
Now, Jim, do you consider the situation now to be is it a revolutionary situation?
It's a pre-revolutionary situation. In some parts of the country, you already have dual power. That is, you have a situation where the legitimate government cannot meet in its legitimate buildings. It has to meet secretly in far away motels or hotels, and the people occupy the government buildings. And that's the situation in Oaxaca, where you have what they call the Commune of Oaxaca, People's Power, a huge coalition involving all the social classes except the very rich and the very corrupt. Basically, a movement from below. And that's what's been going on in Oaxaca for several months now. The slogans are pretty much, Oaxaca is Mexico's future. And Oaxaca's movement, which is a popular People's Assembly movement, as they call it, is going to the National Democratic Convention on the 16th of September. And the night before, you know, the president is supposed to give the grito, the shout of independence from the presidential balcony in the main square. And it's doubtful Fox will be able to do that. But López Obrador will give the grito the night before from the Zoc.
Jim, you've recently been in Cuba, I know. I imagine that the Cubans are following these events very closely.
Right.
What's at stake here for Cuba and for the rest of progressive Latin America?
Well, what's at stake here is precisely, will the leftward or left-of-center electoral trend continue in Latin America or not? Left-of-center candidates have won in all the major countries of Latin America up until this Mexican election. If imperialism succeeds in breaking the back of this trend by imposing this conservative candidate in Mexico, then it will be a great setback for all the progressive forces in Latin America and indeed the world. I think your listening audience should know that the two biggest social movements in the world today, at least in the Americas, are the one going on in Mexico right now that we've been talking about, and the one going on in the United States of immigrants, most of whom, well, let's say more than 50% of whom, of the activists in the streets, are Mexican. So there's a link up being forged between the immigration movement in the United States and the big social movement in Mexico around democracy and human rights, basic rights for the working people of Mexico, whether they're in Mexico or in the United States.
Jim, what's been the United States government role in opposing López Obrador in Mexico?
The role has been blatant since the day that Negroponte, who's the head of these 16 different intelligence agencies, he's the head of Homeland Security and so on, declared the candidacy of López Obrador, or the person of López Obrador, of the Revolutionary Democratic Party of Mexico, a danger. And the U.S. has been engineering from behind the scenes, from the embassy, the way it did in the revolutionary situation or pre-revolutionary situation of 1910, almost a century ago, from the embassy. It's been pulling a lot of the strings. It's difficult to prove this, obviously, just as it was difficult back in 1910 to prove it, but historians later uncovered all of it.
Thank you very much for this insightful interview. We're so grateful for your being on. We're going to ask you to come back. We're going to be following this situation very closely. Our only regret is that when the election was stolen in the United States in the year 2000 and Jesse Jackson wanted to organize a huge demonstration in Florida, the National Democratic Committee vetoed that idea. Gore laid down and Bush came into power. To see what's going on in Mexico, we can only hope is going to be an inspiration for everybody in this country. And we'll be back to you to get an update from you. Jim, thank you very much for being on Law and Disorder.
Thank you, Jim. Michael.
While recording a documentary at the U.S.-Mexico border with Deepa Fernandez of WBAI's Wake Up Call, we caught up with Shanti Sells and talked to her about her case, which had just been dismissed. We want to share that interview with you where she gives us an update.
So Shanti, your case has just been dismissed. Can you recap for us why you were on trial in the first place?
Yeah. I work with an organization, No More Deaths, which is a coalition of groups of people who have come together in response to the human crisis that is occurring on the border, where thousands of people are dying trying to enter into the United States through the desert. They're unable to cross in the urban areas where people traditionally crossed undocumented through the cities and were able to come and go more freely. And now with increased border militarization, people are being funneled into the desert, which is a natural barrier where people are still coming through the desert out of need, and the fact that there are jobs here for them to take, and a lot of people are dying in the process because the environment is so harsh, and a lot of people die from exposure to the elements. A lot of people die from dehydration and hyperthermia and horrible, horrible ways to die. And there's no response. A lot of times people will even find their way to a road and beg for help, and no one will stop for them because they're afraid to interact with that person. They're afraid of prosecution. And so No More Deaths came together as an organized way to have direct aid and direct action for these people that we knew were dying. And I came as a volunteer and worked with No More Deaths. I came for 2 summers and learned the ropes and have been working in the field. And we have a protocol that we had set up with the U.S. Border Patrol, which allowed us to be in the field, to give food and water and medical care in the desert, and also in severe medical distress, evacuate people from the desert to a hospital where they would receive the care that they needed. And the day of my arrest, and the reason of my arrest, is because myself and Daniel Strauss, my former co-defendant, we were evacuating 3 men from the Arizona desert where they had been lost for over 4 days, were suffering dehydration. They all had severe blisters on their feet. One of the men reported blood in his diarrhea. He had severe diarrhea for 2 days. All reasons to get them out of the desert into a hospital where they could receive immediate care. They probably would have needed IVs and other form of emergency medical care that they could not receive in the desert. So we were taking them to get that care at a hospital in Tucson, and were arrested on the way by Border Patrol and deemed smugglers, basically, and charged with 1 count of human smuggling and 1 count of conspiracy by the U.S. government.
Your case was dismissed or thrown out by a judge. On what grounds?
The judge threw out our case on the grounds is called government estoppel. And it's basically, we had filed a motion to dismiss based on this government estoppel in January, and the judge had finally reviewed it and made his ruling just on Friday. And it's basically because everything we do is transparent. We had worked with the Border Patrol and had numerous meetings where we told them who we are and what we do, and declared that everything we do is transparent. And the Border Patrol had watched us do this work for years. They had condoned our work on many levels. And then literally out of the blue, turned around and arrested Daniel and I with no warning as to think the climate had changed and that they were now not approving the work that we do. And so basically it's the government can't approve something and then turn around and prosecute you for it. And so the judge ruled that our prosecution was not valid because the government in the past had condoned our work.
Does this mean you're now free and clear to take anybody that you find who needs immediate medical assistance to a hospital?
Well, that's the problem, is even though this ruling frees Daniel and I of any charges, it in no way has set a precedent or set the principle. It has not addressed the principle at stake, the fact that it should and can never be illegal to offer humanitarian assistance to someone in need. And that was not taken into consideration here. It was more about the circumstantial evidence of the case and about our position at the time of our arrest with the government. But the judge in no way made a ruling on whether or not he feels it's legal for us to do this work or not. And so there is still a lot of work that needs to be done. And establishing this very definite principle that it can never be illegal to offer someone humanitarian assistance, and especially anywhere in the world, and especially here where we are all witnessing a human crisis. And there can be a lot done by individuals, by citizens of the border who, if given the room and given the confidence, could have saved so many lives, because people die on people's back doorsteps. People die on the side of major highways because no one, like I said before, people are afraid to stop and help them.
This is an invitation to all Law and Disorder listeners. We've covered the situation of the Cuban Five on this program, and there's a big demonstration in Washington this coming Saturday, September 23rd. All of us here at Law and Disorder are going to be on the demonstration. We ask you to join us. In fact, Michael, we'll try to make a banner so people can identify us. But this is a very important demonstration. The Cuban Five, heroes really of the Cuban Revolution, came to Miami to try to protect their country against American-supported Cuban terrorist actions against Cuba. The Cuban government went to the FBI and said, we know who's doing this. Here are the notes that our people have taken about who's doing it, when and why. Please help us. The American government turned around, took the notes, figured out who the Cuban patriots were, had them arrested, framed up, tried and convicted in, of all places, Miami, where you can't get a free trial. And the irony is that today they still sit in five horrible prisons around the United States when a true terrorist, Posada Carriles, here's the guy who helped blow up an airplane with 73 people on it, including the young Cuban fencing team. He's been let out of jail as we broadcast.
Michael, I'm really glad you brought that to our listeners' attention. It's really crucial. It's been underplayed in the United States, to put it mildly, and it raises two really crucial issues. One is the U.S. continuous export of terrorism against Cuba for 40 years, the killing of hundreds, maybe thousands in Cuba by terrorism over the 40 years. And secondly, the utter corruption of our court system.
So please, all of you, join us September 23rd, Saturday, Washington, D.C. Go to the freethefive.org, get the information, come out and march with us in Washington. Free the Five.
Law and Disorder was produced by Jeff Brady. We'd like to thank our affiliates and our many listeners.
The ideas expressed here on Law and Disorder are our own and not those of the organizations for which we work.
Porque el campo es el Edén más lindo del mundo entero.